This is my second term. And my first year, I feel like the movement forgot that they got work to do. Your job is to go and talk to every elected. And that's another thing I have to remind us of. I don't care how they voted in the past. Your responsibility is asked. If you never ask the question, they never tell you no. We are assuming they don't agree with us. We are assuming that they are not on this issue. And so we give them a pass. No. You go talk to all 50 of them, and the ones that I think that you can get that you can't, I will do the follow-up work. But it is our responsibility to keep talking to them, to keep holding them accountable, and to stop thinking because they was the devil in the past, they might always still be the devil. But you got to ask. You let them tell you no. My community groups will say, oh, we going to get this to you because we know you're going to cuss them out. Yeah, I will after you do your job. After you go knock them doors, after you go talk to your neighbors, after you go talk to the people who are affected by this issue and need us to fix it, then I'll do it.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
This is your first time in our space. I want to welcome you. I also want to say, I know the last couple weeks, there's been a lot. I'm just going to say that, a lot in the world, a lot in Chicago. I really appreciate people coming together in this space and taking time out of everybody's busy lives to be in community with one another. So thank you. Our event tonight, Chicago Conversations, How We Build and Wield Left Political Power, is the first in a four-part series that we're doing, where we're really trying to curate some space to have Chicago conversations. This event is taking place in person at Haymarket House, but we are also live streaming, so there are folks joining us probably from Chicago, but also folks from other places. And this really is a space for us to share ideas about how we collectively build a better world. So thank you for joining us. We want to acknowledge that Haymarket House events take place on the occupied lands of the Council of the Three Fires, the Ojibwa, Ottawa, and Potawatomi tribes, who are the indigenous keepers of this land, who were forcibly removed, and we stand in solidarity with the 75,000 indigenous people who live here today who continue to struggle and fight for land back, and we stand in solidarity with their struggles for liberation. So a little bit more about this event. This is the first in a series of four Chicago conversations that Haymarket is organizing in collaboration with Asha Ransby-Sporn, who's an amazing moderator, but also an incredible thought partner and ally in curating this series with us. So I want to thank you for all your work making this happen, for coordinating and facilitating these conversations. Also, I want to give a huge shout out to our speakers, Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor from the 20th Ward, Jung Yoon from Grassroots Collaborative. I did that out of order. And Kennedy Bartley from United Working Families. So if y'all think you're busy, these folks are busy. So we really appreciate them taking time to be here in conversation with us. And lastly, I just want to say a little bit more about our Chicago Conversations series. This is my pitch. So come to the other three. Our vision for these conversations is that they're places where people on the left in Chicago can come together and talk about our collective work. We want to meet each other, and we want to engage in healthy dialogue and debate with one another. We know that there are a lot of struggles right now in the city and also in the world, and we also know that we all don't agree on everything. what would be the left if we all agreed on everything? But we all agree that we want to see a better Chicago, and we want to be in struggle together for that better Chicago. So we want to recognize the importance of listening to one another, and that we see ourselves as allies in this struggle for a better world. And so these conversations are not meant to be places where we all agree with each other, but they are meant to be spaces where we collectively build solidarity with one another. Because frankly, it's going to take the folks in this room and a lot more folks who aren't in this room to win the kind of vision that we really need now more than ever. So I'm going to turn it over to Asha to get the conversation started. And again, thank you all for taking time to be here with us.
Thank you, Dana. Thank you, Haymarket. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Really excited to kick off the Chicago Conversation Series. I find myself struggling with a lot of new political and strategic questions about the movement, about the Chicago left in this moment. It is not getting easier, and these conversations are really an opportunity for us to dig in together publicly about some of those hard questions. And yeah, really excited for this panel. Some of the people I respect the most in the city of Chicago, my alderwoman, Jeanette Taylor, just reintroduce y'all, who, you know, before was an alderwoman, was a fearless community leader and organizer who comes out of our movement, and I think you have just incredible insight for us. Kennedy, the executive director of United Working Families, whose leadership is really important in this time and has led, you know, a lot of important work in that space for a long time. And Jung from Grassroots Collaborative, who's also one of the conveners of the People's Unity Platform Coalition and the Illinois Green Deal Coalition. So thanks, y'all. So we're here to talk about left political power, why it matters, how we build it, how we wield it once we have some. But it's also important that we ground any organizing, any movement work, any efforts to build power in a conversation about to what end. Why do we need power? What are we going to do with it? And so, Kennedy, if you wouldn't mind kicking us off with, you know, how do you define the political project you see yourself and ourselves as a part of here in Chicago, and what are the political goals?
Yeah, appreciate the question and appreciate everyone for being here. Hello. I think in terms of the political project, I think that, you know, in this moment, it feels really easy to get kind of caught up in like the electoral side of it and not think about the political project with the question that you're asking, like towards what. I think for a while and for some folks, it was really easy to think like if we just get 26 seats or if we just get the fifth floor, transformation happens, and that kind of negates the nature of the seats that we're contesting for. And I think it leaves a lot of power on the table outside of the scope of electoralism and legislative power. And I think that the concept of governing power is an important one, you know, the concept that recognizes that we have to kind of contest across multiple arenas if we are really serious about like real transformation and not just, you know, piecemeal or, you know, harm reduction type stopgap measures. Yesterday, a number of us kind of echoed, you know, Mi Gente's theory of change borrowed from Chile around, you know, we have to contest or fight, you know, within, against, and outside of the state. And I think that that is what orients the political project that I find myself in and feel deeply committed to. Section part of your question. Oh, and towards what? Yeah, towards transformation. You know, I feel like, I think that like we have to orient ourselves towards doing this work in solidarity for folks fighting for freedom, you know, across the nation, but also importantly globally and hyper-locally too. And I think it's really important that we do things with clarity around like to what end and not just for the sake of doing them.
John or Jeanette, do you want to add on? Something that you always say, Kennedy, which I think about a lot, is I think part of the task that we're called to in this moment is to bring folks that have been kept at the margins to the center. And I think only when we do that can we really build transformative power. And I really appreciate what you're saying about like contesting for governing power at multiple arenas. And to that end, like, you know, political power is different than governing power, and we need to be able to have true governing power to build that transformative agenda. And that looks like taking over not just city council or the mayor's office, but also thinking about where decisions are made and implemented, and how are we contesting for the like the political common sense, and making sure that it's not just an idea, but like down to every single level of governing. And something that I hear a lot, especially in the last 6 months, is like, oh, you know, maybe now we'll have co-governance, whatever that means, right? But we don't elected officials, like, you know, vote on things, but governing really happens at the agency level and the departments, and I think we forget that. And so I'm really interested in thinking holistically so that this political project is successful in bringing the folks in the margins to the center.
Can you ask the question again? 40 is not the new 20.
So I think this is really helpful to hear how folks are thinking about power. And yeah, just want to invite folks into this question of to what end? What are we trying to do with it? You know, what do you want to achieve and win with the power you have in your seat, in the organizing power we're trying to build as a movement? Just really trying to ground in what are our goals.
So what I want to see is socialism. Let me just be honest with it. That's what I want to see.
Yeah.
Like, if I could just sum it up and not give this long, drawn out. People need to be able to control the institutions and space that they live in and we work in. And we've never been able to unless you're white. Let's just be honest about that. And so for me, this power is not mine. The people have allowed me to take their power and use it and go and advocate for them. And so we need to do, I think, what we've always done or what has always happened. If you know how it works, the community organizations find the problems. They come up with the solutions. They write the ordinance. And my job is introduce it and make sure it get passed. It's real simple. It ain't hard. It's not hard at all. I think the problem becomes that we feel like when we get our folks in the space, that's it. So we got a black mayor who is progressive. And I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. Right now, they just want him to wave his magical wand and fix 400 years of foolishness. We fooling ourselves that we think that's going to happen. It's going to take time. It's going to take effort. But it's also going to take you all to still be in those spaces. Just because you got progressive aldermen and a progressive mayor doesn't mean I don't have 24 other coworkers that I don't like and who don't do anything. And so we got to think about that. Yeah, you need 26, you need 34, but we need you all to not stop the fight. It's not enough to get great people into these spaces. You all have to support us and be there and help us think it out, think it through. I don't got all the answers. If I did, hey, I probably would be God, but that's not my role right now. But we all need y'all to not stop the fight, and I know that it doesn't change. We don't have to fight as hard. But we still have to fight. You got to remember, there are loads and loads of legislation to make us fight against each other, to make us different from each other, that helps one group and hurts the other. And so there are some real reform that we got to do. And it don't stop just because folks are progressive. Or, you know, we love throwing that word around. They say they're progressive.
Thank you for that. So relatedly, I'm going to kick this next question to you, Jung. What does it look like for social movements to relate to progressive elected officials that we may have gotten in office, that we may be allied with their vision? You know, what does that type of collaboration look like, particularly when folks either break promises or the confines of government doesn't allow them to meet our demands or implement our visions, what does that relationship look like?
Great question. I want to build off of what you just said, Jeanette, of like, you know, we kind of expect folks once they get in to wave their magical wand, and there have been 400 years of foolishness, and that means 400 years of resistance, so we're impatient, right? And like, understandably so, people are hurting and need change immediately, and so there is this tension, right, between what is possible within the confines of a structure, of a system that was never meant for us to even be in, right? That we have like taken, we're taking over, and the very real impatience of like, oh my God, rent is due like next week and I can't afford it, right? And so there, so that's hard. And I think it, this moment calls for us to hold both and not just, you know, just choose one side. Like, you know, we can manage that polarity, as Kennedy always says. I think for social movements in this time and how we relate, I think it's in some ways like nothing changes, right? We still have to do our power mapping. We still have to think about what is moving the decision makers, what are the obstacles and the threats. And I think we have to take a real strong look at corporate power and the way that corporate power is still wielding a lot of influence on government, on policy, and on some of the implementation stuff that really hurts us. And for a long time, at least in my recent memory of organizing in this city, a lot of times it's been, you know, the mayor is our enemy, and therefore that is our like biggest target. And so I think our strategy has to sharpen and shift in thinking about like, how is a mayor a target but not necessarily an enemy? And how do we create the political space for him to do the right thing, to follow through on the campaign promises he made, and to do it alongside of enough alder people to get it passed, right? I think we should not let up pressure, and we should still keep organizing and demanding what we need to create that. And I think there is maybe a fear-based or a... I think there is some fear around doing that, frankly, right? And how do you critique without that being dissent or... criticism and allowing space for that, because I think that's how we get stronger, that's how we get sharper, and we need that from each other to hold each other accountable. And I think to the same way we need to hold our mayor, our favorite alder people to that standard and call them in, and maybe that looks different than calling them out, but we still have to have that open dialogue.
Cool, thank you. Dig in a little bit, and you, yeah, feel free to jump in on any of this, but dig in a little bit more on, you know, this idea of the mayor may be our political target but not our enemy. And yeah, just if anyone wants to jump in, how do we distinguish, right, between who are our enemies and who are either our political targets or our people on the inside that we want to work, you know, aligned with? Like, how do we put folks in those different categories, and how does that, you know, define how we relate to them?
Happen here. I think that I've spent a lot of time, particularly with the people up here, talking about power, and I don't think that it was much, like, it wasn't much of a discussion before this moment in terms of, like, maybe we were presupposing some things, or maybe, you know, it's easier to think about power when you don't feel like you have any. And I think this moment has forced us to, like, be rigorous in defining what power is and who holds it and how you use it and how you lose it. I think that's probably verbatim the questions you've asked me, Jung, in that order. And, you know, I think that there has been, like, for a long time, a real, like, political tradition or tendency to kind of orient to political office or who's in seats. Like, it doesn't matter who's in the seat. They are a target. And I think that we actually have... experienced, you know, generations of like the real implications of who's in the seat. You know, it mattered who was in the seat when 50 schools were closed or half our mental health centers were closed and, you know, austerity was carried out or neoliberalism was born. And so, too, should it matter, you know, who is in the seat in this moment where we have a real potential to use, you know, electoral, you know, government, whatever political power, you know, towards a different end. And Asha, I feel like I'm getting away from your question, but I'm riffing now and just like how I'm thinking about the moment. But Jung, you said something that I've been thinking a lot about too, which is like, what is the role of our movements, you know, and like, you know, how are we defining movement, especially when like real comrades are like in the inside, quote unquote inside. And I think that it has to be a key function of movement to create contention, like manufactured contention and manufactured, yeah, struggle, because if there isn't like a left constituency being created, the right is going to be as loud as it's ever been without any like counter. And I think a part of our role is creating a constituency to the left that, you know, our elected officials can say that they're being responsive to. That feels like a key role in movement. And I think that to this point on power, it's clear that with the absence of, you know, corporate strategies or the absence of campaigns that identify targets outside of just elected officials, you know, it's not clear that we've all been on the same page in terms of what we're up against, you know, because, you know, the FOP still exists and Ken Griffin and all of these corporatists and such. And so I really think that if we're having the same types of campaign strategies that we've had in all of the decades leading up to this moment, we really have to be critical of ourselves and reassess what our strategies are. And even if they are the same, at least we can say that we were critical, you know, and rigorous. And so, yeah, that's just how I've been thinking about how we as quote-unquote movement orient. And I only say that because I don't mean it to be exhaustive, but, you know, anyways, yeah, how we are orienting to, you know, our allies in an elected office.
I spent decades of cussing CPS out. And so the thought that I have to actually work with them is hard because I don't trust them. I'm just not going to believe that because we got new people in seats that you changed your old ways. We still got closed schools. We still got young people who are not enrolled in schools. We still got young people who are just, they downtown tearing up because they ain't got nothing to do. And so I struggle in this time. I really do, because the people that I've been fighting for decades, I'm supposed to believe now that they're really my allies? No. I just don't. And so I'm trying to wrap myself around how do we now create a space in honesty, hell, and peace. And in a space where that there are some things that now we're at the place where people are now telling us we just can't do it. You could have told us that 23 years ago. We could have saved a whole lot of fighting, a whole lot of cussing out, a whole lot of jail time. I've been to jail a bunch of times. We could have saved a whole lot of things if that was the case at four, but it just seems like, and so we're having this conversation around housing. There are loads of vacant CHA units. HUD has some vacant units. You've never come together before, and so I'm supposed to believe now that you somehow got some feelings, some warm Christmas feelings in your heart, and that now you're going to do it, and so no. So there's this thing around with distrust with elected officials and thinking about how our people respond to us. I think people feel like, oh, we got them in office, we could leave. No, you can't. We need you more than now because we are even confused. And I know people just won't own it. You know, they won't say, because I'm literally sitting in meetings with CPS and city colleges and I'm like, why am I here again? What? How? And so I struggle. I won't say that I don't struggle. And I'm sure a lot of folks in our movement kind of feel the same way. Like, what do we do? But we also holding people accountable. I got a call a couple of weeks ago when I went out to the administration about how we're doing the things with the migrant camps. And I was like,
So I'm supposed to not challenge him because he's my friend? And let me say, I've known him for 20 years. I knew him when he was a lobbyist. He got that seat. There's some responsibility that comes with these seats. And so we can't move past that. And that's the part I think that we move past a lot, because we're friends and we're in coalitions with each other, that because the power structure changes, that we don't hold people accountable. And that's going to be our biggest downfall. It is. We cannot remember that this is still a system created on the backs of us. We fought to get in these spaces. Yes, absolutely. But let's not forget. It's like after you win Monopoly, you think the game is over. No, I still got hotels on everything here. Remember that. And if you hit that dice and you own my property, I want my money. And so that's how I think of it. And so I know a lot of us are, we down at City Hall, and I'm like, never in a million years did I think there would be this many progressive folks, that we would have a progressive mayor. But also trying to figure out, we still got to continue the fights we started before we got in those spaces.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else, Jeanette, that you could say about what it looks like for movement to show up in a way that makes it possible for you to do more? And do you have any stories you could share that are like good examples or bad examples, but good examples would be nice.
So what I feel, so this is my second term. In my first year, I feel like the movement forgot that they got work to do. We can't social media our way out of this, and I know we were in COVID. We can't Zoom our way. We got to go back to the doors. We got to go back to the conversations. We got to go back to us doing the work that we were doing to even get here. And so I ain't going to call out the organization, but came to me and said, we want you to pass this ordinance. I said, okay, so tell me what electeds that you talk to. Oh, we ain't talk to none, but we want you to. When we start doing that? When that start happening? No, your job is to go and talk to every elected, and that's another thing I have to remind us of. I don't care how they voted in the past. Your responsibility is asked. Does anybody remember when we used to go to Springfield and we had them big old report cards? I hated them things. Oh, I hated them so much. They used to drive me nuts because I didn't understand why we got them. We would give people an F. No. If you never ask the question, they never tell you no. We are assuming they don't agree with us. We are assuming that they are not on this issue. And so we give them a pass. No. You go talk to all 50 of them, and the ones that I think that you can get that you can't, I will do the follow-up work. But it is our responsibility to keep talking to them, to keep holding them accountable, and to stop thinking because they was the devil in the past, they might always still be the devil. But you got to ask. You let them tell you no. And so that's the kind of thing I'm dealing with, where my community groups will say, oh, we're going to get this to you because we know you're going to cuss them out. Yeah, I will after you do your job. After you go knock them doors, after you go talk to your neighbors, after you go talk to the people who are affected by this issue and need us to fix it, then I'll do it. And so I want us to move back from that, because I feel like people, they didn't in the first term, but now it's gotten worse. I had a community group come to me and like, we want you to advocate for this money in the budget. I said, okay, well, what is it that you all want? We need $1 million. Okay, that is a drop in the bucket, but for what? Oh, we want to build housing. See that silence y'all got? That's the silence they gave me. As if I was going to do the work. No, that is not my responsibility. We are in coalition together. We work together. There is some push and pull in this. And that has to happen for us to create more real change in this work. And people cannot pretend like, yeah, we can count to 26 now. That's an amazing number to me now. We can actually count to 26, y'all. But even with that 26, what I think people realize is, and I used to say this all the time, it don't matter how much money you put behind a candidate. If those people are not coming out and vote, you can forget it. If those people are not there in support, you can forget it. And so in order for me to actively do my job, I need you all in the movement to do y'all job. And I don't see myself removed from the movement. Mm-hmm. I just feel like I'm just another leg of the movement that we didn't grow in this. And so that's kind of what it is for me. But yeah, don't still knock doors. Still call people. Still have them. Listen, when I was organizing, we used to meet about the meeting. Oh, Lord. I'd be like, if they call another meeting about housing, and I was young then, but I get it now. We have to be talking to each other. We have to know what you said hurt me. I apologize. Teach me how not to hurt you. We still have to do that type of work, and we got to take care of each other. I'm so tired of seeing y'all tired. I want to say the last election cycle, and that last year before we got in, the movement had it. We had it because y'all ain't taking care of y'all self. It's called self-care. It ain't selfish. Let me tell y'all something. Die today. They'll have your job announcement out tomorrow. You ain't even cold in the grave. They will take care of yourself. This has happened for decades. This has been happening for years. And so it's just time for us. It's going to take us time to fix it. And it's not going to happen overnight. And what we got to stop doing is not having these hard conversations. These conversations about race, about gender. If we don't have them amongst us, what y'all think going to happen when we get out in the street? They're going to use that very thing that we refuse to talk about and come to terms with against us and break us up. And that's right now, that is the right's gold. Their goal is to break the movement. We were not supposed to get the fifth floor. We were not supposed to have 26 seats. And y'all remember what we do in Chicago? They do around the world. And so their job now is to break us, and we can't do it. And so we're going to have some times where I'm be like, Kennedy, I can't talk to you today. I'll talk to you tomorrow. I'm hitting reject on the phone. And Kennedy know I love her. And I'm going to call her back tomorrow. Might not today because I had a bad day. But that does not mean you don't lean on me. That don't mean you don't call me. That don't mean, Damon, I'll see you back there. That means we still in coalition with each other. That does not, just because my title changed, does not mean I've changed.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism, Debates in the Second International, 1900 to 1910, edited by Mike Tabor. At its height, from 1889 to 1914, the Second Socialist International represented the majority of organized workers in the world, with the revolutionary goal of overthrowing capitalism. Its major accomplishments, such as the 8-hour day and International Women's Day, testify to its lasting influence around the world. In this important collection of debates at Congresses of the Second International, Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism captures the International's vibrancy and gives a snapshot of its strengths, weaknesses, and contradictions. As David McNally puts it, this book is a treasure chest for every socialist seeking to understand the history of their movement. Bringing together documents from 1900 to 1910, Mike Tabor shows us how socialists more than a century ago analyzed and debated key questions of their time. Find Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism at haymarketbooks.org.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, a lot of that was profound. But, you know, maybe this idea isn't revolutionary to this room, but the idea of getting folks in you know, seats of power isn't to, like, affirm that power is, like, just held at 120 whatever North LaSalle. It's like, for community power, and if we want to win things, we've got to, like, continue to build public support for our issues to show that there's community pressure, not just, like, a lone progressive on the inside championing a thing.
Thought that we feel still fighting for Bring Home Chicago is sick. We had homeless people for the migrant crisis. Come on, y'all. This ain't hard. It ain't rocket scientists. And then you got all of these folks who for years have voted against it. Now, I'm going to vote for them out. Don't y'all believe the hooly hoop? They just want to keep them good jobs. We make $150,000 a year. We got good dental and health insurance thanks to you great taxpayers. Do not be fooled by these folks.
Sorry. Yeah, no, that's great. So it's budget season. The mayor's office has released, you know, our first proposed budget. There are some very, very long budget hearings underway. And there's a lot of challenges to balancing and creating a budget, many things that need funding. Movements want to see mental health clinics reopened, which we're going to see, which is amazing. Investment in programs like the Peace Book, increased investment in housing. There's scrutiny on the police budget, which has increased. And then the influx of migrants and efforts to shelter them will require a lot of spending. So yeah, could folks talk about what is in the budget and what's your analysis of it and maybe what you'd like to see different?
So just a few kind of to just put a finer point on some of the summaries you said. So we did see some, like, good things happen so far, which is the result of decades of organizing. So some of the treatment on trauma demands we're going to see two public mental health centers reopened. We're going to see the non-police crisis response program expanded beyond just a pilot program. That is huge. And I don't think we can, like, we shouldn't overlook that or brush past that. Again, decades of organizing, of door knocking with the TNT referendum that folks up here led. And that's huge. That's huge. And again, it's not enough, right? And so there is this tension of making progress, but like we have so much work to do. And so sometimes winning feels like losing, and it's hard, and that's hard to sit with. Some other really good things we saw in this budget announcement is the reopening of the Department of the Environment, again, closed for many, many years. Very good first step, not enough funding to make it have real teeth, but a good first step. We saw some like TIF stuff happen to get reinvested, expansion of youth employment, violence prevention, things like that. And we heard during the budget hearings that DFSS intends to include some of their funding and put that towards the Peace Book, which Good Kids Mad City has been organizing around for years, which is very, very exciting and really good. And there's a lot of bad things in it, right? The police budget increased, and ShotSpotter is still in the budget. And some of the key demands of Treatment Not Trauma and Bring Chicago Home, as it is connected to the defunding of the police department, are not included. And so I've been really thinking about, and just had a conversation this afternoon with a bunch of organizers, like, what does it mean, right? Like, we're planting seeds, and I just kept coming back to this like garden metaphor of like, these are seeds that will grow into something, and what will 5 years from now look like because two mental health centers are reopening, and how's that going to impact my neighbor? And really thinking about not just what is going to grow from this moment, but how does that shift the political terrain that we can organize in? And how does that enable us to do even more, to grow a bigger garden? And so we should call out the bad. We should say that this is unacceptable to increase an already bloated police budget. And we really need to build up life-affirming institutions so that people's imaginations can expand outside of this room of what life could look like without police, and not, and to know, oh, actually, I don't need that because now I can call this other number and get a crisis response worker. And we need more people to have like tangible experience with alternatives to community safety, I think, before we can build the kind of political power that we really need to defund the police. And yeah, so I'm that's where I'm sitting with it, and I have to just trust that people much smarter than me, like Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who talks about like abolition is about presence more than absence, like I'm really just holding on to that and like hoping that that's true. because we have to keep fighting.
Yeah, I mean, I won't go through like the line by line analysis. I think that you did a good job, Jung, in laying out what's in it. And I think the way that I've been conceptualizing the budget, which, you know, we've spent a lot of time over the years on the budget, you know, creating, well, first of all, before there was like a Chicago Budget Coalition, I think we changed names like four times. Like there were a bunch of young people importantly calling our attention to the police budget being, you know, 40% of the budget. And, you know, there, our attention was necessarily turned towards like different line items. But just for some historical context, you know, beginning in like 2019, we kind of formed this table, this coalition, where, you know, elected officials and labor and community groups figured out how to come to a consensus around a set of four or five demands that would kind of, I think it was like a first iteration at a trial inside outside strategy, you know, like, this is our assessment of the budget. This is what we need to see. If we don't see it, vote no. And, you know, we understood that we only had like 9 at the time, but a part of it was also like a structure test of, can we get our people to vote as a block? And also, can we get our people on the outside to come to a consensus? And I think that the muscle that we were building is the idea that despite there being 40 community groups, we couldn't have 40 red lines. And we had to think about this work on a particular arc, like on an arc. And I think that muscle, and it's like kind of coming to me in this moment, was like the thing that's necessary or that we're having to use now. Because this is like 1 of 4 budgets. Like, we don't have a guaranteed 8 years or 12 years, but we have a guaranteed 4, you know, God willing. And so I think that as I'm seeing it, it's kind of a down payment on proofs of concept, you know, and that's what you're naming, Jung, like, one, we have to win a mass group of people to our hypothesis, right, that we don't need police and surveillance to keep us safe. And I think the way that we do that is we have to have, like, institutional reflections of those hypotheses by way of the reopening of mental health centers, by way of investments in Peacebook, by way of reopening of the Department of the Environment, to create the conditions to be like, we've tested this thing, and it works, you know, and that creates like an argument for like scaling it up. You know, to your point, you know, a lot of, you know, us up here, we're leaders in the treatment, not trauma referendum. And I think that that was a test because we were told, you know, that sure, like, white leftists on the Northwest side believe in alternatives to policing, but not black people on the South side. And then we, you know, ran a referendum in the 6th Ward and the 20th Ward that asked explicitly, do you want to send, you know, a social worker and an EMT to mental health crises, specifically instead of an armed police officer. And on average, 97% of people said yes. And shout out to the 33rd Ward, because we ran it there too. And I think similarly, we have to create the conditions to turn our hypotheses into mandates. And so, you know, I'm seeing this budget as a down payment. And I think that it's important, yeah, that we name like the good in the budget and not just in the abstract, like, you know, it's good because we've been fighting for these things and now we see it. It's good because like our neighbors who like don't just need treatment, not trauma, but also need housing and also need youth employment and also need violence prevention are getting this in this budget. I kind of see it as like a budget that maybe fights back, you know, against austerity and neoliberalism and, you know, the alternative, and it's not perfect, and I don't think that, you know, we thought it would be, and it's funny that we're even able to, you know, critique the reopening of 2 mental health centers is not enough when we couldn't get a hearing, you know, a year ago. And it's like, we should be that audacious and that, like, you know, like, have some swagger to the fact that, like, yeah, we were right. We deserve these things and we deserve more. But I think it's important to sit in, like, the you know, material aspects of this moment. And when I say that, it's like the impacts that they have on, like, real people, you know, and be critical of ourselves about what work we need to do to make sure that, like, a majority of people are bought into our idea. So it's not this, like, fringe group of leftists abandoning these things, but it's, again, it's a mandate. And, you know, a lot of us maybe, like, conceptualize the mayor's win as a mandate, you know, because I think he won, like, because of his public safety platform, not despite it, and I think that we should be responsive to that. And, all, you know, and not like, yeah, well, I'll go off, but just one thing, you know, I do think it's important that we remember that piece, you know, because I think it's easy once you have power to do this thing where you try to placate or, like, get the, you know, some legitimacy from centrists, you know, the people that we know will never legitimize us, and it's critical that we keep the base. You know, the numbers don't lie. If we won by 51%, fine, like, that, it's more than 50, so, or 49, so, you know, I think that we should stick to, like, what the mandates are and make sure that we see this as 1 of 4 years, but remember next year that last year wasn't enough, you know, and so demand more, and keep organizing in the interim for the conditions to, for, you know, a mayor that would be responsive to people saying we need more.
You can clap. That's good.
They wasting y'all money.
They wasting y'all money.
Yeah.
It's somebody in one of these departments that's spending $400 on pagers. Who still use pages? The city is so wasteful, and I'm just so this. I'm on the inside looking out. We're wasting money on stuff that we should not be spending. And so what I've been asking them for or having a conversation is having a forensic audit at every department. We are wasting money on stuff and we continue to buy. Like, if you think about, like, all the little fancy pamphlets that they put out. We all got phones. Somebody could scan that code. Stop wasting my money on stuff. Y'all know how many trees we kill? How many forests we didn't kill? That's it, y'all. And we all got fancy little iPads and laptops. Touch screens. The city is very wasteful, and I spent a lot of time at the budget. And if you've been watching, I'm apologize for my angry moments, but I'm tired. This year five. Stop lying to me about what y'all spending our money on. Stop fooling me. Y'all don't a lot of what y'all don't understand. All of the corporate money that we get also comes with corporate donations, and so people are buying us stuff that we need for the city, and they lied like they spent the money. That's what I done found out. They got hidden buckets. They got hidden lines. Y'all need to look at that book. There are lines that literally say flowers and trees. When the last time they done planted a tree somewhere? I'll wait. How much they spending? So today, animal control was up. Now, y'all know raccoons, possums, squirrels, all of those are protected animals. So what are we spending all this money for? Why do y'all got a budget? That's what it is. If they all protected animals, ain't none of us protected animals, but I guess. So it's like, to me, we're wasteful with the people's money, and we spend it unnecessarily. And so I'm going, there is a department that spent $10,000 on travel. Where are you going? That's what I asked. And if you look at the budget meeting, you will see, where you been? Where y'all going? What y'all going for? You ain't doing nothing here. What do you need to go to another state for? And that's a Zoom call, ain't we? All got Zoom and Teams, don't we? We spend good money on it. So it's like, be mindful of you're spending the people's money. And let me tell y'all something. Although I'm Taylor cheap with her own money. So I'm definitely going to be cheap with y'all money. Like, you can get the 5-cent paper clips, not the 25-cent ones. And those are the type of conversation. Y'all laughing, but I'm serious. Procurement is a hot mess. They are. They spend... I want to say in the last 3 years, they spent $10 on nails. Who got a $10 nail in their house? Raise your hand. Ain't not a hand up, is it? So why are y'all allowing people to abuse the city's money? It's the same thing, and I'm going to bring this up again, with the migrant crisis. People who normally would charge $500 for rent now want $2,000. Are you serious? Some of y'all make $15 an hour. Now you come up here because you're helping us with a crisis and you want to charge $40. Please stop it. Please, y'all irritate me. The amount of money we spend on flowers and maintenance. Now the tree is on grid. You can't even call 311. Don't get me started. You can't even call 311 to get a tree trim now. They do it by grid, which means they go from section to section to section. Grid doesn't work that well with garbage. Why would we do it with trees? And the amount that they're charging for cutting down trees, the amount we're spending to get grass cut. And I'm going to say, I got 3,500 vacant lots in my ward. It takes them a month and a half to cut all of those lots. And a lot of those, matter of fact, almost all of those are city-owned. But we doing something wrong. The math ain't mathing. The math is not mathing. And so while people think that it's just, let's say we want in the budget, pay attention to what we spend our money on. Well, not our money, y'all money. Because we all pay. The time you go to the store, okay, how old or how young you is, you're paying taxes. Pay attention to what they're spending the money on. We're very, very wasteful in the city of Chicago. We just are. And every time I bring it up, somebody be like, it ain't your money. It is. Because every time they put that direct deposit in my account, I'm spending it on something here. And so it is. And so for me, it's me looking at this budget and saying, we don't have to spend that amount of money. That's too much money. Dues, subscriptions. Pay your own dues. Why am I paying your dues? What kind of subscriptions y'all getting? What's these Essence? What kind of magazines y'all buying? And I'm questioning them all the time, and they just freak out and go, no, we want to know. And so it's us really taking a look at that big book. Y'all see them books. So just imagine you give 50 people 4 of those books every year. we just killed the rainforest.
Thanks, y'all, for those reflections on the budget. My last question, and then I'm going to open it up to anyone else who has questions. So in the past couple of weeks, we've seen, I think last Saturday, there were 25,000 people in the streets in Chicago in solidarity with Palestine. And that's, you know, a small fraction of people around the world. The week before that, we saw a pro-Israel resolution introduced, contested, and ultimately passed through city council. And so, yeah, Jung, and then if other folks want to add in, how should we understand our work here in Chicago as interconnected with other struggles globally, and why is that important?
I forget who said it earlier, but people do look to Chicago, and I think that might be true, but I don't know. I think we have a duty to stand up to injustice, and we live in an empire that wages war for profit, and it is really interesting, or like, I don't know, something I really just sit with and think about, and I don't have an answer, is like, what does it mean? Why, you know, to fight for justice within an empire, and feeling so far away from the levers of power that are like sending bombs to harm my friends' families. Like, that's terrible to sit with. And anyone who thinks you can just gloss over this or it's not our problem, then what are we doing? Right? And so I think it is deeply shameful and disappointing that city council passed that pro-Israeli ordinance, and that there, you know, that there is such a silencing of anyone who speaks out for Gaza and for Palestine, and a fear of like, oh, I don't want backlash. But there is genocide happening, and so we have to speak up, and we have to do everything to be ungovernable in this moment. And so I do think everything we do, you know, even as like organizers and elected officials who are thinking about hyperlocal issues, we live in a global society, and everything we're wearing was probably made in a different country, and everything we eat has been imported. Like, we are all deeply connected under capitalism and under imperialism. And so I think we just have to all think really hard about what our roles are, right? What is our role in the BDS movement? What is our role in like turning out to the streets for these demonstrations? And it does seem like the tide is shifting. Right. Today, students from over 100 universities walked out for Palestine, many of those in Chicago and from dissenters like were organizing that. And that's powerful. And we have to keep going. And I think, I do hope that the tide is shifting and that people are starting to be less afraid and starting to see the war propaganda more clearly for what it is. But we have much work to do. And so I just, call your representatives every day, you know? So.
Yeah. Oh, do folks want to add? I think that was great.
Okay. Yeah. I would like to just chime in about, just to let the record show. I thank you, Jung, for calling it what it is. I think a lot of times we are in situations where perhaps there's some, you know, legitimacy to like the dialectic of, you know, things aren't black and white, but, you know, sometimes things are genocide or not genocide, and what's happening in Palestine is genocide. So, you know, and I think that it's really important for us to, I find it useful to think about the context under which we're living, which is, you know, globalization and imperialism and capitalism and being in the belly of the beast. And I think that so long as the right kind of like sees solidarity with harmful dictatorships or whatever it may be, like across the world, you know, so should we find solidarity with folks fighting for freedom globally and across, you know, the country. And, you know, to the extent that it isn't explicit, like where the interconnectedness, you know, it's hard not to think about the fact that there were times where this was, I know I'm also in an echo chamber sometimes, but, you know, a common through line of, you know, IDF training police officers here and us sending white phosphorus there. And I think that, like, it's living in empire kind of implicates you or like creates a level of complicity. And so I think that really the only way that we get to challenge that or, you know, do what we can as people living under this social order is be unapologetic in, you know, where our loyalties are and to the extent that, you know, we can have ethical consumerism or whatever, you know, be, you know. Yeah, I don't know. It's like very difficult to think about doing this work siloed from a genocide happening, you know, and attempt to navigate this world without like naming that, because I have to hope and I know for sure actually that, you know, given the 2020 moment, you know, our comrades in Palestine were saying Black Lives Matter. And so I think that it's really important that we are just like clear and to your point, like bold. And, you know, I think there is like a level of courageousness that you've been, you know, naming in terms of, you know, it's challenging and it's scary and all these other things. But, you know, these compounding crises aren't going to get better. Like we are living through late stage capitalism and fascism and all of the other things. And so I hope that we start modeling how we intend to resist, you know, now and not bank on getting better at it later. So,
yeah, thank you. I'm going to open it up to questions. If you shout it, I'll repeat it if folks can't hear you, or I'll repeat it for the live stream. Thank you. I'm going to repeat it because we have people on the live stream and this is what they can hear. We got some affirmation for Jeanette showing up in the budget hearings, and then a question of how do we see through and make this distinction between the real limitations of the confines of government and what is what things are staying the same just because that's how they've always been done. How do we navigate and see what that real distinction is?
Eggs. It's really that it's eggs. And so my first 3 years, I asked them everything. I'm like, how much do paperclip cost? How much do paper cost? How much do chairs cost? How many times do y'all buy furniture? Where does the furniture go when y'all done? Just ask. It's a matter, and we don't, what I want people to realize with this new administration, we got to remember there is still entrenched with ROMS people and Daley's people. They are all up in these departments and the committees, and a lot of times that's where the decision's made. It's basically given to the mayor on a pretty piece of paper. They put in keywords that he know that he might read or might not read or he not like, and they say, pass this, we need this. To your point, we don't. We don't. We do not have to continue to do anything that we've been doing for decades, which is hurting people. We don't. There's no reason for it to still happen. And it's a part of this thing. We've been having conversations around looking at all of this old legislation. Because a lot of things were implemented. And when people don't get their ways, what they do? Let's put in the ordinance. Let's put in the ordinance to mistreat people with brown socks. And let's give all the money to people in red socks. Well, why? There's never a why. They can't never tell you why. They just do it. And so it's... Now we get a chance to pull off the layers. This city of Chicago is an onion, and we're peeling off the layers slowly but surely to see, like, why are we in this space? And from my standpoint, it doesn't have to be. It does not. But also what we don't have is time. People have been hurting for so long, they won't change right now, which is why we're all in the uproar. That's why, listen, they didn't jump. Two of my coworkers in City Hall, literally. They come in City Hall, they're standing behind us doing
regular city council's meeting and they're cussing us out, they're going off, and they're frustrated. They're frustrated because they feel like we've forgotten about them, and we haven't. It's just peeling off those layers to say, what is the right thing to do? How could I help you without hurting somebody else? And government has never done that. They ain't ever cared. They like, as long as we give the people who are voting what they want, who's going to support us, who's going to put money in our political campaigns, we're going to help them, not realizing we've hurt tons of people. And so it's us pulling back the layers, but it's also back to what I said. It's some conversations we're going to have to have. We got to get out of each other's way. Right now, we in each other's way. We just are. My needs are supposed to be more than yours. No, they're not. This is what 40 looks like. Well, this is what after 45. My knees is killing me. That's why I got to stand up. My knees was going dead. But just because I can't stand doesn't mean she doesn't stand with me. That doesn't mean she doesn't help me stand. That don't mean she can't stand for me. And if we operate in that way, we get a system that we could actually start to trust and we'll actually start to put, because people still are not trusting of government. I work there and I'm not.
We'll take two questions at a time. Do you want to?
Yeah, sure.
So thank you all so much for coming and for everything you've said. I'm really interested in the fact that, you know, this year it's 40 years since when Harold Washington got elected, and there's a lot of parallels. A lot of people have drawn parallels between that moment and this moment. And I think one thing that's really importantly different is the broader political context when Harold got elected 40 years ago, of a daily machine still running the state, a Republican governor of Illinois, and Ronald Reagan as the president. Yeah. And today, like, we're in a different situation. It's not great, but objectively a fundamentally different situation. The machine doesn't really exist the way it used to. J.B. Pritzker, you know, is the whole thing. And then, you know, and then we have Joe Biden as president. And it's not Reagan, but it's still not great. And so how do we think about that? How do we relate, knowing that so much power is also at the county, state, federal level? And how do we engage with that?
So I'm going to unpack what you said. Why Biden is not Trump, he may be a couple of steps above. Let's call this what it is. Tell me what JB is doing that's so great for the state of Illinois. Where is his voice even in Chicago being one of his strong cities? We're struggling. He's been silent. So these people are a step up. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't never want to see Bruce Rauner ever again in life. But I also want somebody who is better. It's not enough for you to stay out of the fight. If the state of Illinois is fighting, I expect JB, I expect Brandon, I expect everybody to be swinging together. And right now, Brandon is being left to swing on his own. Our congresspeople are not even supporting in the way that they could and should. And so it's really no different. We should have got behind Bernie, and I'm just going to say it. We should have, and if we knew better, we would have. Because let's be honest, Trump and Biden, and I'm going to say it and people ain't going to like it, Biden is the one of the lesser evils. Tell me what he's done that's been different. But think about just our country in general. We are the same people that will bomb a country and then throw food boxes at them. Let that marinate you for a minute. They know what's going down at the borders. They know absolutely people are being treated. And let's not forget, these people are running to this country because why? And I ain't gonna cuss, but we messed up their countries. Let's not pretend. And then we make special rules for folks who are a little lighter than others. So we got rules for the Ukrainians, but the hell with everybody else, huh? And so let's call it. See, we don't do that in politics. We won't call people out and say what it is. I will. I don't care. I don't, because I got in this work because God told me to, and I know that's funny. Now, I told him I wanted a rich husband and the Mega Million numbers. And he didn't hear that request. But he heard me say, I'm a run for alderman. So we just have to call out people for what they is. And I'm going to be honest with y'all. The election is coming up. Don't be standing behind that man. Don't stand behind him. Don't support him for what? They have left us to fight. And actually, they've helped create, knock on wood, what would be a race war. Now stop me when I'm lying. You're pitting us against each other for crumbs, but y'all printed money for COVID. Y'all have money for the right. Y'all can send money overseas, and not to say that we don't help our brothers and sisters over there. We are not doing right by our own. And you hear that rhetoric in the black community a lot. What about us? What about us? Absolutely, what about us? We got homeless people in this country that's been sleeping on the expressways for years. That's on all of us. But that's also on, and y'all stop listening to this rhetoric. Republicans are doing this on purpose. As a matter of fact, Republicans and Democrats are playing with our livelihood right now. Because they're trying to make it so bad in Democratic states that you're so mad you turn into a red state. They ain't cared about you before. You think they gonna care about you now? I'm going to go with the Democrats. And believe you me, I always tell a person I'm an independent Democrat. I don't think like they think. They think for themselves. Well, they think about themselves. I don't. I think about other people. Just like I eat and live comfortable and have lights and gas, I want you to have the exact same thing. I don't care what color you are. I don't care what your sexuality is. I don't care how old you are. And so we cannot be fooled and thinking that we're doing better because we're not. And so, yeah, that's... You got me on that one. I couldn't let you go. I couldn't let you believe that it's what we do historically. It's the one of the lesser evils. Hell.
I'm going to jump in myself on that question and then invite a few more folks. And just the thank you for that. You know, thinking about the difference between when Harold Washington was elected and now, I think there is an important thing of Brandon Johnson is a lot less alone in City Hall than Harold was, and that should mean that he has a lot more room to move a progressive agenda. So I think that's just like something to think about as we make that, you know, comparison and not leave it just like on, you know, comparative symbols of like black male political leaders, like really different landscape of who else is in power. Okay, I saw a few hands. Yeah, if you can go ahead. You've got a hand, Mark. And then Mark. We'll take them all.
We're gonna bring this to you, Barbara.
Do you want to come up? If you want to come up, that would be great.
Well, here you go. So my question is, how do we balance like raising awareness and consciousness about like a lot of the things we want versus building power and winning elections? Because I've seen some nasty stuff happen in elections where I've seen like. You know, one union, for example, will support Brandon, but then will attack an aldermanic candidate over defund stuff. So how do we handle those kind of things and hold people accountable? Because in my opinion, we kind of push the movement back when we do those kind of things and we allow people to get away with it. So how do we, where do we draw the line in the sand of, you know, pushing the collective consciousness on these issues? And when does it become more important to win versus actually pushing our ideas forward? And then I guess my follow-up is how do we heal up or
something like that. Yeah. I think we can actually take all three questions at once just because we don't have a lot of time left. But thank you for that and heard on the challenge of it.
I can talk from here, but you're trying to get it on here.
Sorry. Thank you.
Right.
4-part series. Progress. Yeah.
So I'm going to sit on the front row. So I wanted to go back to the question Asha asked at the beginning about toward what end. And I think we can get mired in talking about governing power. But it, in a way, it is a little bit of a trap, I want to suggest, in that, you know, the problem with movements here and all over the world is like once they become institutionalized, you know, it loses some of the radical edge when movements of the 60s and 70s, people went into the Democratic Party, people went into universities, and people went into the nonprofit industry, and all of that was a de-radicalizing process. So how do we, you know, and the goal is not governing power, it's to govern to what? Because good people in bad systems still do bad things, right? Mm-hmm. Or they do less bad things. So how do we get systemic, how do we think of systemic change while also acknowledging that we have a certain governing structure now? And I know, you know, it's a big, you know, we just have to keep trying to think about it, right? And I don't have the answer. But we really didn't answer that question about toward what. I mean, what looks like a fundamental shift, you know? I mean, when resources are redistributed, when not just people in general, but people who have been left out are actually making certain kinds of decisions and we see a shift in resource distribution. Is that a fundamental change? Yes. We dislodge corporate power. I mean, you know, like these are the kinds of metrics that we have to think about in terms of systemic change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a few more dollars is good, and I don't minimize that, but it's not systemic change. Yeah.
And I heard when I did ask the question, right, you know, thank you for naming, right, we want socialism. And, you know, if we're thinking about 19, you know, however many progressives you count in city council and a mayor, like that's actually, and then a really strong movement, that's actually not even enough to get socialism. Like, what do we think we can get with the power that we have? And, you know, what is our vision for how we're wielding it? And I think that's a great last question to end on some final words around.
You gave this to me.
Here. Okay. Yeah. Would you like to? Sorry.
Okay, yeah. Real sit down. Okay. I'm old now. One thing I will say is this. You know, most of you in this room, you know who I am. Spending so long inside of a prison and coming back out to this society, it's some things I'm not happy with, but it is a lot that have changed. I think that a lot of people in this society fail to realize that our president that we have in office, man, he put so many handcuffs on us that it's going to take us a long time to undo some of these things that have affected us as a people. But we got to keep fighting, and we cannot give up. And the fight is not in Alderman Teller. You are a winner. But if you don't see that you are a winner, then we're not going to go anywhere. If she gets sick, then the whole movement stops. So think about that. Love you all.
Thank you. Whoever wants to jump in first.
So Mark is right. Young people, y'all got some work to do. It's time for y'all to take this over. I want y'all to think about this. I had a coworker who was in office for 49 years. Guess how old I am? 48. He's been in office that long. And to your question, I like everything that you asked and said. We got to be honest with each other, but we also got to own our mistakes with each other. Too often when things happen in our movement, we just sweep them under the rug and keep moving. We cannot do that. And what I'll end with is, we can't do to them what they've done to us. And I feel like some of us have that mindset. Like, we finally in power, so now we're going to mistreat everybody. No, that is not what the movement is about. And that ain't why I got into the movement. That's why, not why any of us. The folks that are on this stage, with the exception of me, should be in these electoral seats. I agree. My chief of staff, everybody in my office is under 35. That's intentional. First of all, they take care of their little old lady. That's me. Second of all, they come up with ideas and thoughts that wouldn't even cross my mind. They think outside of the box. And so, young people, we need y'all. We need y'all in lockstep. Y'all need to be in these spaces. My chief of staff for the education committee is 22 years old. I met her when she was 16. She ran my phones on both of my campaigns. I won both times because of her. At some point, I will be passing this space over to her. And I always get this thing that she a young person, and she should be. And so, young people, y'all got to help us fix it. Y'all can't be afraid to challenge us either. Because the one thing that I know that happens on that fifth floor, and it happens in the 20th Ward, they make you way too comfortable, and they give you everything. And that is not, they don't challenge me. Kennedy does. Asha does. Asha will call that office in a minute and say, hey, they gave us all tickets. What you gonna do? I'm gonna call them and see why they gave y'all tickets.
Was it Alex? Okay, I'm sorry. So Alex, we all know Alex. She called me about the tickets. Look, but those of them saying, hey, I love Alderwoman Taylor, but I'm going to hold her accountable. We still have to do that with each other. We got to call out what happened, because you're absolutely right that happened. Even when we were doing REMAP, there was an issue with Black electeds and Latino electeds. And I sometimes have more in common with my Latino electeds than I do with some of my Black electeds. And the thought that we had those issues with each other and we never talked about it has not helped us heal, has not helped us fix it. So we got to do that. And it's us being, what I could say that needs to happen more than anything, we need to be transparent and honest with each other.
Thanks, Jeanette. Yeah, Barbara, I appreciate, like, you know, in your question was an offering of a framework, and I think it's like a useful reminder, or, you know, I don't know if it's a reminder for everyone, maybe it's the first time, but I do think that there has to be some, like, yeah, collective discussion around, like, our metrics for success. And I think it's, like, you know, both, like, how are we measuring the success of the administration and also, like, how are we measuring the success of the movement, you know? Because I think it's, like, I'm thinking a lot about, you know, in 4 years, you know, what do I want to say that, like, we push the administration to do? But also in 4 years, like, what will movement look like? And I'm thinking a lot about, and shout out to Jesse Sharkey, who, like, you know, called my attention to, like, just, you know, like, the conjunctures, you know, and, like, how different this moment is from, you know, previous moments, you know, and the conditions are different. And I worry about us focusing so much on, like, the inside part of the inside-outside strategy. But that's a big question, Barbara, and I don't obviously have the answers, but I feel like I do have a commitment to, like, starting to name that, because embedded in your question and in yours, you know, it's like, if we don't have an identifiable towards what, I don't know, like, what it is that we're doing or how we know, like, where the points of, you know, reassessment or recalibration are. And, you know, I think there is something to, you know, some of, like, the material wins, though, that we get just because of, like, the human side of the other part of it. And I do think that sometimes this idea of governing power, despite me using it a lot, can be kind of abstract or rhetorical, you know. And so it's a good, like, reminder, I guess, to just be more specific. And I think that understanding how bureaucratic and slow government is and how inherently harmful and evil government is under these contexts, I think we have to, when I say governing power, I think we have to think about what are the other elements of, like, the things that make up this world that we have to be contesting for power in, that we have to be taking up space in, that we have to be looking to. And it goes back to the inside, outside, within, or inside, outside, against, you know, the state piece for me. But I think that, yeah, we just came out of a rapid or, like, a long period of just action, action, action. And now we've won. And I don't know if we've done, like, the reflection or study part. And I think that these are the questions that remind us that that is, you know, it has to be something that we stay, like, committed to. Otherwise, we just keep kind of doing the same things with no real test, I guess, outside of, like, you know, more, like, precarity, if it's, like, effective or not effective. So,
thanks, Kennedy and Jeanette. Just to add on, like, power to what and how we would, or how I think about measuring success, you know, towards socialism, yes. And, like, I think for so long, because we've never had power, it's very easy to just name, like, this is the thing we need. But now our task is to, like, name the path to get there, and what does implementation look like, and how do you break that down? How do you actually, like, localize socialist policy and, like, you know, redistribution of wealth and big government for the sake of public good? And that's what I'm really interested in building for, or building towards, and campaigns that demand things that do that. So I'm very interested in things that, like, take on corporate real estate and how we think about the housing market at large, right? It is fueled by speculation and private investors, and therefore housing will never be affordable. And the way we have dealt with that under under neoliberalism is to privatize and to, you know, just give, like, just encourage the private market to do the right thing. We know that doesn't work, right? And so how are we using this administration to fight back and demand new things like social housing, or new investments, and thinking about the government's role? And so to me, success looks like everyone in our neighborhoods, in our city, saying, you know what, actually, I want my government to do the right thing for me. I want fully invested schools, and these things are a public right, and I'm owed these things as a resident here. And so I think that is what success looks like, and, you know, how we can make the most of this moment is if we start running towards policies and paradigms that shift us in that direction.
Thank you. That we can clap. Thank you. Thank you to our panelists, brilliant people fighting so, so hard, just like all the love to you all in the world for the work that you're doing every day. I know it's not easy. So this is a first in a four-part series. We hope to continue to dig in and keep getting sharper as we go about that question, right? I've been studying some old budgets a little bit, going back to Daley and everything, and it's very clear, right? The decades of neoliberalism that we're trying to reverse, you know, how incremental and slow that process that teed Rahm Emanuel up to, you know, really gut public infrastructure in, you know, some really big decisive blows took a long time, and it was moving in that direction very clearly. How do we think about this time that we have, that we are in Chicago, to really think about a decisive shift in a different direction? Excited about that. Our next conversation is going to be on November 29th. We're going to be on the South Side at Build Coffee in my neighborhood. We're going to specifically be talking about public safety, joined by Tamar from Mothers Against Senseless Killings, Miracle Boyd from Good Kids, Mad Cities, and Alderwoman Rosana Rodriguez from the 33rd Ward. Our third conversation will be December 14th. I mixed that up the other day, my bad. Here back at Haymarket, we'll be talking about housing justice. We'll be joined by leaders from Bring Chicago Home, from the CBA Coalition, and Alderwoman Angela Clay. So hope to see folks back out, and thanks for coming out.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.